I'd like to welcome everyone present, to thank my colleagues, and to say that this initiative organized by the Instituto Storia Contemporanea intends to integrate what was the program of the Constitution of Portuguese Republic, where the first time the universal vote right is considered. The group has proposed to the Parliament to organize an international conference to analyze the role of the women. Will this program add a big adhesion of international and national organizations regarding the conquest of the right to vote? There are several practices that will be analyzed by the feminine vote, the participation of electoral campaigns, participation of the electoral acts. In this way, in a comparative in different regimes, the issue of the feminine vote, when we started to be discussed with the new concept of citizenship. This started at the beginning of the 19th century in the United States and England. There are still some countries where women don't have the right to vote. In Portugal, it was only consecrated in 1946. So this initiative for its Citizenship Act is inserted in the commemoration of the 46th anniversary of the Portuguese Constitution. I want to thank the Parliament, Portuguese Parliament, that has supported us from the first moment, Dr. Ruth Costa, Dr. Fátima Abrantes Mendes, Dr. Paulo Fonseca, Dr. Pires da Silva, and Dr. Ana Oscar, obviously to my colleagues of the organization. So we're going to start the first panel that will be moderated by Dr. Marina Costa.
Bom dia a todos.
Good morning, everyone. I'm very honored to be here in the Sala do Senado, Senate Room, for this conference on women's citizenship and the right to vote. And I thank the invitation that was addressed. I'm going to speak in English because my first invitation. Guest of this panel is English, so I'm going to go in.
This conference, it's a great pleasure to have you here. Professor Sarah Childs is a professor of politics and gender at the University of Bristol in the UK. And in that role, she has researched and published very widely on gender studies, women's political representation, and its relation to the institutions, especially in Britain and within the Conservative Party, if I understand correctly. So she has published in 2015 two books, one called Gender, Conservatism and Representation, and the other called Deeds and Words, both with ECPR Press. She has been working also with Paul Webb, which is someone I know, and I've also worked with him. I really like him. And recently, she's been special advisor to the UK Parliament's Speakers Conference on Representation. So Professor Sarah Childs has been not only an academic, but she's been involved with politicians in the UK to advise on women's representation. So it's a great pleasure to be able to chair this meeting, and I will invite you all to listen to Professor Sarah Childs on her reflections on the political representation of women. Thank you.
I'm going to stand if that's okay, because I feel like I just prefer it, actually. I like to be able to see people and to be a little bit more in control of the room, I think. So first of all, thank you very much for inviting me today. It's really nice to be back in Lisbon. It was the first time that I've ever had rain in Lisbon, so I'm slightly getting used to that, normally expecting it to be lovely and sunny, but again, so beautiful to be here in this wonderful room. Today's talk, really what I want to do is try to rethink and reconsider the trajectory of the study of women and politics and the kind of questions that we've posed and the kind of research that we've undertaken, and also to think about that which we still need to do. Clearly, politics and gender has become something of an established part of the discipline, that there are more of us, and I think this conference is an example of that. There's a substantial body of work out there. And I think our research is very often agenda setting, challenging the mainstream to rethink its research questions and quite often to moderate its conclusions as a consequence of the kind of questions and the data and the insights that we can provide. So our research definitely speaks to the mainstream, even as it constitutes a sub-discipline in its own right. I think the mainstream doesn't always speak back to us. Recently, I reread one of my favourite authors, Margaret Atwood, and her novel, The Handmaid's Tale. I first read it when I was about 17, so rather a long time ago. And I became horrified all over again about what happens to the lead character, Offred. And one aspect of this novel, it's always a disturbing novel, but that really upset me this time, was about Offred's loss of access to her bank account. One day she woke up and she no longer had access. It had been transferred to her husband. And it made me really think about how often we don't think about what we might lose, losing the everyday, and therefore whether we really take seriously enough some of those rights that we have acquired and that we just presume are part of a democratic society. And I think it's worth reminding ourselves just how much women had to fight for those rights and perhaps how precarious they might be. And I say that even more powerfully, I think, given the last 2 weeks in politics and the failure of Hillary Clinton to break that glass ceiling and the kinds of rhetoric and arguments that we are seeing playing out in populist movements wherever they are. And I think it's a salutary reminder, if we're talking about women and citizenship and political rights, the certainty I think that we maybe once had about the extent to which those rights were secure and actually able to be always realised needs to be reminded in such a public fashion. So I hope you don't mind me indulging myself in making that claim. The granting of women's suffrage in the UK, we're about to celebrate its 100th anniversary in 2018. And there's a lot going on in Parliament to commemorate that right. And I think, again, we have to realise this is our great-grandmother's generation. It really isn't that long ago. And, of course, it's not a right that is universal as yet. And we might also want to think about some of the intersections that maybe make it much harder for certain kinds of women to acquire those rights or to put those rights into practice. So I think it's worth cherishing women's suffrage rather than taking it for granted, and to also think about collectively commemoration or the collective commemoration of all of those who fought for that right. And I think fight is often, again, a term we should emphasise. So if we think about women and politics and that relationship between the two, again, I would want to emphasise that politics should be a place for women's interests and women's issues, even as those concepts prove quite troubling in terms of feminist theory and in terms of practice and in terms of party politics and indeed parliaments. All good Democrats should care about the relationship between sex, gender and politics, not just feminists. It's not just a feminist concern, it's also a democratic concern. So I want to try and pose some questions about participation and representation and to think what it is that we are seeking from politics and how we might go about securing what it is we want from politics as gendered bodies enter the political arena, enter political institutions and seek that representation. So I won't speak directly to all of my slides, but I hope they illustrate some of the points that I'm making. I want to start by just thinking about the kinds of questions and the trajectory of how we have identified those questions. So, if you like, we start by counting bodies, we then think about what difference women make, and we think about the conditions under which that will happen. We have found ourselves somewhat, I think, in angst about what we mean by women's interests and women's issues. It's caused us lots of problems and still does. We've problematised the idea, as I sort of say to my students, that women's interests exist in a shopping bag that the representative can come along, pick up and take into Parliament and somehow deliver for us, that actually constitutive theories of representation challenge the ability to think about representation in that way. And then the research moves on to thinking quite harshly, I think, about conservatism and representation. And I feel even more challenged by this in the context, perhaps, of right populism and the extent to which some of those arguments about gender and conservatism and representation may not cope with anti-feminist politicians. I was interviewed by a journalist last week from the Evening Standard. I'd spoken to her the night before, pre-Hillary's loss. I'd given her this upbeat account. And then she rang me at sort of 7:15 the next morning going, bloody hell, what do we say now? And I was rather cross, and I said something like, you know, I'm really cross about having an anti-feminist president of the United States. So I think we have to think what the representation of women might mean when those doing the representation have very misogynistic, sexist and anti-feminist predispositions. Gendered institutions. I had a wander around the corridor. I saw all the wonderful pictures of the speakers. My colleague, Dr. Cruz, was telling me that you have yet to have a male speaker in the Portuguese Parliament. We've had one in the British Parliament. So to think about the kind of institutions within which politics takes place, and also to think about what might need to change about these institutions in order to make them more inclusive and diversity sensitive. And then I'll return to this problematic relationship between feminism, bodies and identities, because that really troubles us. It's hard to translate from theory into practice. So still counting.
Websites, no
system. Go to very regularly to see who's moving up and who's moving down, and to remind ourselves just how far from parity in terms of numbers in most of the world's institutions women are. So we often see, I don't know whether this happens here, but in the UK, politicians are clever enough to surround themselves by women at every photo opportunity. And quite often in the House, although I'll show you an image later on that will show you that they sometimes forget they probably need to have some women on the front bench. But just to think about how far we still need to go to achieve parity. We can think about what those numbers tell us. They count women's bodies, and we may feel certain about that, but it seems to me that when we have debates about trans communities, we might need to think again about whose bodies we're counting and on what basis. But I think still counting has a very valuable role to play, because it reminds us that numbers go up and numbers go down, and the rather romantic story of an onwards and upwards trajectory is too complacent. There is fallback. There is nothing certain about achieving parity in politics. And I feel that very strongly, not least because, despite the fact that quotas have become such a huge success as an electoral system intervention, the antipathy towards them is often quite strong. But we mustn't presume that it will get better, that we just have to wait, that passivity will deliver us parity political institutions. This is a representation of the British Parliament. It's a terrible slide if I was teaching mathematics, but I think it's again a very salutary reminder of just how overrepresented men are. And again, the studies show that globally, elite majority men everywhere dominate. So we need to be aware of the kind of issues that we need to address, and the interventions that might well be necessary, even if you do not like them. It's so funny in the British Parliament, they like evidence-based interventions and policy making, except when that suggests that you need to introduce sex quotas, when they wish that the evidence wasn't quite so globally strong, at which point they rather nervously say there's something still rather problematic about quotas and it doesn't quite address merit, and wouldn't it be discriminatory? Looking at the percentages of women in parliaments overall, I think is worthy. It is important to look at patterns, but I think it can hide quite a lot. And I think, most importantly, it can hide differences between parties. So we can look at the British Parliament and see it's now just about 30%. But actually, of our governing party, they are only 20% female. It is the main opposition party that is over 43%. So again, some complacency can set in when you see the overall percentage without recognising that that achievement may well be dependent upon the electoral fortunes of one party. And if that party was to suffer a significant swing against it at the next election, then those numbers would come down. It's also the case that the UK is currently debating whether to reduce the size of its institution. And for those who wish to see more women in Parliament, we are trying to encourage a commitment by the political parties to have no woman left behind. It's quite possible, though, that in the crisis that we might call Brexit in our country, that those boundaries, we may not reduce the size of our House because it may just be a little bit too difficult for the internal party workings. I asked a Conservative MP last week, would he put money on the House of Commons getting smaller? And he said only a tenner, so £10, €10. So we may not see it, but I think where we're having institutional changes, we might need to put into place protection to prevent those numbers of women go down. We don't have enough to lose any, is the argument I'm trying to put there. In terms of trying to understand what's going on, what explanations account for women's underrepresentation, people often want a single explanation and a single and simple answer. And the problem, one of the problems we have when we deal with the real world, when we speak to politicians, is that lack of singular solution, a panacea, causes them both problems in that they have to adopt a multi sort of strategy approach, but it also gives them, I think, an ability to do very little. So once you've sort of reconciled yourself to the fact that they probably are not going to like quotas for reason of political ideology and I think also internal party management, you're then sort of left suggesting the need to do 6 or 7 or 10 different kinds of interventions, and then they'll always prioritise, it seems to me, those that are least disruptive of their dominant ways of acting. So there's much to do in the British Parliament, as there is elsewhere. And again, I think some of the international work on this by international NGOs is really important. And it seems to me there is lesson learning between institutions. And I think the IPU's emphasis on gender-sensitive frameworks for parliaments has the potential to be something that can mobilise. And I'm trying to create competition in the UK by just reminding them what Canada's up to. I've been told that it's best not to point to the Nordic countries because, again, resistance is quite easy because what you get is, oh, we can't do what they do in Nordic countries. They're social democratic, much more feminist. You need something that's a bit closer to Westminster. So if I can find good indications of what's happening in Canada, British parliamentarians are much more sympathetic. So moving on from still counting, we have to recognise that questions are asked as soon as women get into politics, about what they will do. They come under gendered scrutiny. Will they be up to the job? Can they cope with the heat of the parliamentary kitchen? Do they say the wrong things, wear the wrong clothes, do the wrong things? Are they good enough? And obviously in the UK with our second Prime Minister, we have extensive media copies. She wore a rather amazing red dress last week. I don't know whether that made it at all to your press, but I mean, the British press was kind of obsessed with this rather daring. I mean, how can a woman in her sort of 60s wear such an evening gown? Anyway, I think she looked fabulous, but she's, you know, quite clearly someone who engages in her fashion. So these questions, this gendered scrutiny, are they up to the job? Are they good enough? Are they tokens? Are they male equivalents? Are they too spineless to rebel? Are they just being used by political parties? It seems to me that the male politician norm is that against which the female politician pretender is judged, and often judged very harshly. They are also asked about what difference they will make for women. And I think we need to ask that question, and ask of that question whether we should always be adding on to those representational responsibilities, substantive representation. Should women, when they enter our political institutions, act for women? We may want them to, right? That's completely okay. But should we judge them if they fail not to do so? Should that difference that they make be feminist? And of course, this takes us on to the now, I think, very central question of gender and politics, which is about that relationship between descriptive and substantive representation, between being a woman and acting for women. And what does that actually mean? I think there quite clearly is this expectation by feminists, but also amongst women in society. And I think it's completely intuitive. But I think as academics, we need to problematise those expectations because we might be burdening these women. And therefore, when they fail to act, if they do, they find themselves being judged. Critical mass. It's a very attractive idea. I had to go to so much effort in a report a couple of years ago that was produced by the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Women in Politics to keep it out. Politicians love the idea of critical mass. It has the potential to see change overnight. We just need to get to 30%. Everything changes. Activists like it. It's reassuring. It's actually a mobilising concept. If you tell people that if a few more people are present, things will change, things will get better, then there's an incentive to actually participate. It's worth just noting or being reminded of the fact that Moss Cantor was very clear there are three possible outcomes. Critical mass refers to that first. With an increase, things will change. But beware of her second and third proposition. Increased numbers of women does not necessarily deliver change. And again, there is resistance to criticising this concept from politicians, from activists, and perhaps even inside ourselves, because we want change to happen. But the absence of change can often be nothing to do with the desire of the women who are in politics. They can try very hard and fail. So even if you want to act for women in political institutions, you may struggle. We need to distinguish between seeking to transform an agenda and being able to deliver outcomes, legislative outcomes, policy change. We may not be as free. Those safe spaces to intervene may not be as free or as easy to access as we thought. So we need to think about what difference women and men can make. This is a piece of legislation about human fertilisation and embryology. And if you look at the votes, who votes in favour of this piece of legislation and who votes against, then party is the most important determinant of how people voted. So some mainstream critics will suggest that actually the sex of the representative doesn't matter. But if you look at the kinds of framing, the arguments that were articulated in the debate, you see sex differences. What you get, in effect, is leftist women talking about women's bodily autonomy against conservative men who are deploying scientific arguments. Leftist men are very absent from this debate. We don't know why, perhaps for honourable, perhaps for dishonourable reasons. Conservative women, again, marginal. So actually who is present in the debate can be very, very important. So I would reject those who say that the sex of our representative doesn't matter, even if we can't be as certain as we might have wanted to be, or as perhaps, as I would put it, that too much of the straw women accounts of gender and politics suggest. We have never been so foolish, so unthinking, to presume that getting women in will solve the problem of women's representation in a feminist direction. Which women get to be present in our parliaments is very important. So that concept of critical mass is one that, with a colleague of mine, Mona Lena Crook, we suggest that people should walk away from. In favour of the notion of critical actors, those with a lower threshold for action who wish to institute change, and in so doing, generate that change. And that might encourage others to act with them. But it might not. It might generate a backlash. And it might be that sometimes those critical actors will not be women. They may well be men. We need to, if you like, shift from asking that question about when do women act for women in politics to how does the substantive representation of women occur. So looking at outcomes. This, however, takes us on to the rather problematic terrain of women's issues and women's interests. And again, there's been extensive debate in the literature about this. How do we know what women's interests are? How do we know which interests those women representatives should be acting upon when they get into our parliaments? It's proven difficult empirically and theoretically to think about this concept, and also, it seems to me, to study it in situ. I think it's useful to distinguish between women's issues and women's interests and to keep those discrete. And this is work that I've done with Mona again, but also with Johanna Kantler and Karen Seelis. To think about women's issues as being those broad areas that apply to women and that women's interests are the particular content. So we might argue that there are some women's issues that are universal. So we might think of violence against women as being one of those. But the content or the response to that issue may vary. People will have different ideas of the diagnosis and of the prescription to addressing it. Hopefully, on violence against women, that might also be universal. But in lots of other situations, as you see on this slide with the question of the veil, there may be competing feminist positions. And again, that raises questions about who gets to speak for women and who gets held to account for acting for women. And we need to think, it seems to me, about how we're going to judge the good substantive representative if we have an understanding of women's interests that suggests there may be competing and perhaps even conflictual understandings of those interests. A lot of work on this. And I think when we're trying to then do empirical study, when we're judging what's going on, when we're trying to grasp empirically that process of good substantive representation, we have to grapple with these kind of ideas. Some of the more creative theories of representation, which suggest that what constitutes women's issues and indeed women's interests are played out, are created during the process of representation. We can think about how political parties make certain kinds of claims about what is appropriate for men and for women. And this is a very UK-based slide which takes images from a Conservative Party manifesto, so the kind of publications that a political party that would put before the electorate in advance of a general election, and to think about the kinds of ways in which it's constituting notions of what is appropriate behaviour for men and women, but also about gender relations. I've also engaged in overtime studies, which actually quite interestingly see a decline in the amount of coverage given to women as a category, replaced by notions of parents, which we might think is a good thing, but we might also problematise if it hasn't itself thought about the division of labour amongst parents. But here we have, in the six little photos at the end, a representation of gendered crime, which is about having your handbag stolen in the street, whereas in previous manifestos, there have actually been very overt references to violence against women, domestic violence, so a kind of changing conceptualisation of what counts as violent. We might also want to explore the extent to which political parties make claims about what they will do for women and actually to what extent they deliver on those. So they may well increasingly, it seems to me, at least in the UK, we have good inter-party competition over what myself and Rosie Campbell have called women's issues. So all the political parties, including our UKIP, I guess our most populist rightist party, even they had a few pages in their last election manifesto on childcare. So about 6 months prior to the election, that wasn't part of their agenda, but they too have been infected by the inter-party competition over this terrain of issues that the political parties present as being particularly for women. And I guess this this also takes us on to thinking about what we do with conservative parties. And having worked initially on leftist political parties and moving over to conservative parties, it was quite an intellectual challenge to get my head around what Conservative political parties were doing because of the extent to which we often conflate substantive representation with leftist political parties because of that association between feminism and parties of the left. But it's becoming increasingly clear, I think, across Europe, and in the UK case very explicitly in the run-up to the 2010 election, that the Conservative Party was trying to play the politics of catch-up. It was trying to get more women into Parliament, and it was, as these images suggest, trying to address some of those issues that the Labour Party, having been in government, had really put onto the mainstream political agenda. And it's clear that feminism doesn't speak for all women. We might want it to, but it doesn't. And therefore we might need to think about the ways in which conservative women have interests too, and that conservative actors may seek to act for those women. I think it's also true in the UK case, at least, that in terms of descriptive representation, getting more women into Parliament, the Conservative Party adopted very liberal feminist approaches. And it seems to me that that liberal feminism, and I say this up until the 2015, well, the recent events, I'm not sure how I feel about the current government, the government post our referendum. But prior to that, we can also see that that legacy of a more liberally feminist government under New Labour from 1997 onwards was very much inherited by an incoming Conservative Party. Now, there are big debates in the UK about whether or not the austerity economics that were put into place post-2008 were, by very definition, disproportionately and negatively impacting upon women. But in terms of what we might think of as the safe women's issues, kind of strangely, given that 30 years ago, taking action against violence against women was seen as very radical and not mainstream, there are now a whole series of issues where governments of left and right are putting their attention and at least rhetorically supporting the kind of interventions that feminists have been arguing for a long time. But at the same time, that's countered by this tension with debates around economics. Of course, we are, as an individual and as an academic and as a feminist kind of activist in my own little way, I am terribly worried about the rights that women had and have acquired as a consequence of membership of the European Union. And I think there is a lot of work being done in the UK at the moment to ensure that this government, in whatever kind of Brexit it manages to, seeks to, ends up with, that those rights that were guaranteed by Europe or derived from Europe are not lost. One of the most influential books I read as a PhD student was written by Sylvia Pashevkin from the University of Toronto. And what's interesting about the Thatcher era, so Mrs. Thatcher's era from 1979 to 1990, was that there weren't very many rights of women overturned, but that's because Europe stopped the British government. So feminist activism in the UK is very concerned about what will happen to those rights. So going right back to the beginning when I talked about complacency and feeling precarious, I think in the UK at the moment we are very concerned about what will happen. And the fact that we have a female Prime Minister, and one who, you know, has a liberal feminist record. She has been active on getting more women into Parliament. She pushed domestic violence and violence against women. So this is not that it wasn't part of her agenda, but where it fits with her governing rationale remains to be seen, and I will leave it at that. So let me now move on to thinking about gendered institutions. When we were talking about critical mass, one of the obvious criticisms of critical mass is that it presumes that women can just enter an institution and change them. A great deal of literature on feminist institutionalism makes it very clear that we do not enter institutions of our own making. They have historical gendered legacies. This is a chart, don't worry too much, but it comes out of the report I've just written on Parliament. It gives you traffic light, red, amber, green signals for how good or how poor the British Parliament is doing in terms of diversity-sensitive analysis. We have one unambiguous green, which is the establishment of a new women and equalities body. But everywhere else, there is a hell of a lot to be done. This is a very good chart in terms of being instrumental in deploying it to politicians and to officials of the House. What I want you to really think about here is how often when we're talking about getting women into politics, we problematise the women. They lack ambition. They lack the resources. They don't try hard enough. They're not quite good enough. We very rarely problematise the institutions and judge them for how inclusive they may be. This is not very old. This is David Cameron, our previous Prime Minister. He forgot to put any women on his front bench. This was the picture from the next week has them everywhere. So again, we can think about what it feels like to participate in an institution where you look across the chamber. We don't have hemicycles. My goodness, don't suggest that in the British Parliament. This is way too European, continental European for the British Parliament. We don't have enough seats. We're about 200-odd seats too few in the British Parliament. So you'll find yourself squashed, standing up. You don't have your own seat. Women will talk about it feeling like it is an example of harassment. You would never work in environments like this anywhere else. But that's a whole other lecture on culture of the British Parliament. But one of the, I think, really important things to take away from this emphasis on gendered institutions is that we can change things. There can be change. It may not be very easy because of that recognition that we do not enter institutions of our own making, but that the agency of women, particularly within these institutions, may enable some change. I spoke a moment ago about the Women in Equality Select Committee. This was established just after the 2015 general election. Select committees hold ministers and their departments to account in terms of, not in terms of legislation, these are not legislative committees, but they are able to hold and ask ministers and their departments about their focus, their spending, their priorities. And this Women in Equality Committee has had a very, very active first year. And here what you see is an image of them speaking to four male, very senior members of political parties, the leader of the Labour Party, the party chairman of the Conservative Party, the leader of the SNP in Westminster, and the leader of our fourth party, the Liberal Democrat Party. What's interesting about this is the Labour leader sort of says, well, I hope you're going to ask women about why there are so few women in Parliament. And she sort of replies, it's your fault that I have to speak to all four men. So a very, very obvious example of a regendering of the British Parliament that absolutely puts the issue of women and equalities as part of the everyday structure of the House. Except that this institution, this Equalities Committee, is not yet permanent. So they allowed it, but unless there is a new ruling of the House, it will not survive into the next Parliament. So one of the things I've been trying to do is persuade the government that they should act on this, and they've said they will support it. But they did so in the same debate where they said they weren't going to ask political parties to publish their parliamentary candidate diversity data. So you might want to think about why did they go on this reform but reject reform on getting the information as parties select their candidates for the next general election about just how diverse those selections are. I would put it to you, but not to be tweeted, that is probably about the fact that the governing party doesn't have that many women ready to be selected. And maybe they think that this committee can be powerful. And what's interesting is that they are still waiting for the government response to some of their reports. So there's a whole PhD that somebody needs to do about the effectiveness of new institution within the House. I wanted to also say something about this new, and I actually adore this piece of artwork. This is the New Dawn picture. If you Google New Dawn artwork and the British Parliament, there is so much information about this installation on the British Parliament website. It is artwork to celebrate 100 years of women's suffrage. And it was the result of an artist being in residence in the House. Now, the Works of Art Committee in the House of Commons is another body unto its own, often populated by very small-c conservative members. So what's really fascinating is that this amazingly large, very contemporary, glass and light installation has been put in a very central part of Parliament, and it absolutely foregrounds women's suffrage. The light follows the tide of the Thames, so as we go to high tide, it's fully lit, and as we go to low tide, the lights disappear and you have only maybe one and two lit. And that was felt to reflect the kind of tides of change that the women's suffrage movement was trying both to ride but also to resist. It has the women's symbol underpinning or hanging down from each of those glass discs, and it is about an open portcullis, which is the gate. I don't know what the word would be. I hope that translates. Sorry, translators. The portcullis is the grill that comes down in the castles to stop people coming in, and this one is open. So it has extensive artistic merit, but also politics very much behind it. And it just, I think, is a really important indication that there are those within the British Parliament who are prepared to question some of the historic ways in which art has been produced in the House. One of the other recommendations from my Good Parliament report is that we should get rid of something called the 10-year dead rule. We have a rule in the British Parliament which says in the Palace of Westminster, to have a portrait, you have to have been dead for 10 years. And this law, or this ruling, came about because there was a donation of a portrait of the first woman MP to take her seat in the House, and Parliament didn't want this picture. They didn't want a portrait of Nancy Astor hanging, so they had to quickly have a rule to rule it out. So a misogynistic rule from the start. I am pretty certain, although again not to be made public yet, that that rule will go, that they have finally realised that you cannot have a rule that was, that emerged to keep the portraits of women out of the British House of Commons. So let me begin to draw this to a close. I want to return to that problematic of counting and thinking about how we address the attendant issues, the associated issues, when we have women in our political institutions. We started by counting women. We then added in an emphasis to think about the diversity of those representatives. We can perhaps then, and perhaps we should, move to no longer looking at individual characteristics, but to think about intersectionality to a much greater extent. This is a hugely challenging intervention or problematic for gender and politics scholarship. But perhaps we maybe need to think about recognising that all representatives have intersectional identities. It's just that we very often, or lots of people very often, don't think that men have a gender, and that white people have an ethnicity. But I want to sort of really kind of close with this fourth point, and to think about the fact that when we're trying to understand what our representatives do, we need to draw on the work of Suzanne Dovey and think about preferable descriptive representatives. That actually what we're really trying to grasp is the quality of that representative process. To really think about how might we get to a position where we can be confident that our representatives are representing those who they are formally elected to represent? And that sometimes we rely, because they are so intuitively attractive or reassuring, we sometimes rely too easily on looking at bodies and not always looking at what those bodies do. And I will end there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Childs, for such a fascinating talk. You've raised lots of issues about women's representation in Parliament, both in theoretical terms, but also giving us your perspective on recent UK changes, which are so important to how democracies function generally. I share your worry about recent events in the Anglo-Saxon world, in particular following Trump's election. I think that there is a huge risk of a backlash. Not only did Hillary not get elected, but there is a risk of a backlash against women's rights, I think, today in consolidated democracies, because what Trump stands for is a huge backward shift in terms of his attitudes towards women. So I do think that feminists will be called upon to stand up and fight that those changes. I see that there are lots of people here in the audience who are experts on women's issues. So I do have some questions of my own, but I will open the floor first to see if somebody would like to ask any questions that right away.
Hello, I'm Anna Spirit Sant from Ishkte. Hi, Sarah, I liked a lot your presentation. Thank you very much. Of course, I had read many of those things in many of your articles. I completely share your and so many feminist scholar concerns about these women's issue, women's interest concept. I've been thinking a lot about it. And something that you said now that I'm not really sure of is the difference. It seemed to me that you said that you think there's a difference between women's issues and women's interest, or that you found a way to deal with that. I understood your idea about women's issue, but I did not really get what you think about women's interest. And I wanted to ask you one more precise thing is, what is your opinion about the concept of gendered issues? Because it seems to me that that's a better solution, because gendered issues would be issues that are, from a biological point of view, more connected to women. So those are issues whose legal framework is of greater concern to women than to men. That's a concept of Anne Phillips, as you know, so I don't know. For me, it seems that that kind of solves the trouble of having to decide what women's issues are. Okay, I might say something later if there's a chance. Thank you so much.
Anyone else would like? We can collect, say, two or three questions. If anyone else would like to ask something. No? Well, I'll ask a question. I've worked on the field of personalization of politics, and I was wondering, I mean, to me it seems that there's a trend in terms of having very personalized politics and mediatized politics, and also celebrity-type politics, which seems that is a very male-dominated world. And do you worry that it seems that we have two trends? We have a trend where there is more women's representation in lower ranks of political institutions, but at the same time, the mediatization and this celebrity politics tendency makes it much harder for women to actually become leaders. Thanks.
I'll answer the last question first. I recently read a rather fantastic piece of work about the beauty contest route for women into politics that is or has been found in terms of Latin America and in US politics. And one of the interesting aspects of that, in part, is to do with the kind of skills that having participated in beauty... I'm not advocating this necessarily as a route for more women into politics, but some of the skills of that you acquire as being a beauty sort of contest participant is about confidence and about being on the public stage, sometimes public speaking. But it also, one of the aspects was the celebrity version of the beauty queen approach. And that was also about the representational aspects that you speak for the area that you represent as a beauty queen. So that what it points to me, I think, is the way we understand celebrity and the images we have of celebrities and it goes right back for me to that, you know, male politician norm versus the female politician pretender. And if you have a very singular model of who makes the good politician, and that's hugely gendered, then women will always, nearly always, be found wanting. It seems to me as well, in this era of celebrity, women are often celebrities through their bodies and not necessarily through their minds. And it seems to me that often in politicians, how can I say this after what's happened, that minds are what people want. But yes, I think it just adds another sort of model of being a politician that women will almost, are more likely than not to struggle. I don't always think it's about acquiring the resources. I mean, you know, we just had the most credentialized woman trying to be president of the United States. So getting the right credentials isn't enough. So absolutely. And I also wonder whether in part it's to do with ensuring. Ensuring sounds too strong, too inevitable. But are the goalposts moving? Maybe we need to think about that. That as women acquire the qualities, the resources that on paper should deliver you into power, the resources that you need become something else. And I mean, that sounds terribly conspiratorial, but it seems to me in the last 2 weeks maybe we can and maybe we should be thinking in some ways about that. Going back to Anna's point, it's really interesting for me the rhetorical power of gender versus women in a real-world context. When I talked about gender in the British Parliament, many of the MPs and the officials thought that I was talking about women and therefore thought I was talking about discrimination. So that's one way in which gender is seen to be a hidden way of addressing women by those who are perhaps of a less sympathetic persuasion. I also worry that sometimes we shift on to gender in a way that neutralises the hierarchies of gender. So we talk about gender affecting everybody and decisions being for parents and for families as if the gender relations were equal. So that's another worry I have about shifting onto the terrain of gender and sort of losing women as a category. I absolutely accept that there is an alternative reading to that, which is to think about gender as being everywhere and still as being hierarchical and maybe revealing the way in which all issues play out in gendered ways, given people's individual experiences that will be gendered and will be kind of contained within a hierarchy. So I think there are sometimes political, very, very sort of practical political decisions to be made about when you use terms like women and gender and when you adopt words where the actual sex and the gendered experience of those individuals gets hidden. For me, women's issues is a way of identifying those concerns that disproportionately affect women and or affect women differently from men. So the gendered issue of childcare may be experienced for the most part differently between men and women, even if they share or can see it as a gendered issue. And in fact, that example will also, I hope, help illustrate the difference between women's issues and women's interests. Women, if we accept they disproportionately take care of children and care of other relatives, may share this issue. It's a women's issue. But in terms of the women providing the care or the women in receipt of care, then their interests may be very different. So if we have a problem with social care of the elderly and the elderly group are disproportionately female, the interests of those elderly women may be different from the interests of the women doing the care, and they will be disproportionately women. So I think, in simple terms, it's about recognising that there may be competing diagnoses of the problem and prescriptions for solutions, and there may not be just one solution. And I think what that really tries to address is an assumption which says, here's a set of universal women's issues, here's a feminist solution, good substantive representation is identifying the problem, agreeing on the solution, and delivering it, and recognising that there will be different voices, many of which will be making representative claims for women, but having different kinds of solutions. And therefore, what makes for good substantive representation is deliberative kind of democratic spaces where those competing interpretations of what is in the interests of women can be reconciled is the wrong word, but where they can be articulated and where a solution can be the outcome of a deliberation. I hope that helps a little bit. Anna.
Okay, if someone else wants to say something, I don't need to say. Okay, thank you, Sarah. You might then tell me where you've written about it so that I read and try to figure out if that's really what I mean. But I have to say that I disagree that we should consider issues that disproportionately affect women as women's issues. Or it's not that I disagree, but I'm afraid of taking that decision, as you know, because there's the risk of crystallizing then those issues around women. That's why for me it seems a better strategically it seems better to only look at issues that are obviously and for everybody connected to women, like more connected to women than to men, like abortion or other issues. But I understand the idea that, and you mentioned that in the beginning, that we should speak to the mainstream, and that sometimes we need to take strategies to make our discourse easier also to the outside. So in that sense, it might be a good strategy. And I see, for example, the substantive representation of women is an easier way to sell women's physical presence to conservative parties than other arguments. So from that perspective, I could see, but I don't know, I still have some trouble to accept it. Thank you.
I have another question, which is something that is often, which I encounter when discussing women's issues, at least here in Portugal, is to, some left-wing MPs and other left-wing people generally resist the feminist agenda because they think that you cannot consider women as a whole. You need to consider women in different social classes. So it's no point just saying there are women's issues, because one thing is if you are a working class woman and the other is if you're a professional woman, then you have very different interests and you're not. And what you should really be doing is you should really be worrying about working class women if you're left wing and not women generally. So do you encounter these sorts of criticisms to a feminist agenda, and how do you respond to that? Thank you.
In many ways, the shift from that question of thinking about or asking when do women act for women in politics to asking when does the substantive representation of women happen and what constitutes good substantive representation precisely is about being able to answer that question. Because it looks at, not at this idea of interest being defined a priori and in a very singular fashion, but recognising that there are diversities of women out there and who will have competing interests. So that distinction between issues and interests is precisely to be able to capture that. So going back to the childcare issue, you know, in the UK there will be women taking care of other women who are paid below the national minimum wage, because of the way in which they don't get paid for the travelling between the 15 minutes they give to the person in need of care. And of course those interests are absolutely distinct from other women who may wish to reduce the amount of taxation that the government has. So I think absolutely that shift in analytic framework is designed precisely to be able to recognise the fact that there will be, using the words of Mike Saywood, an economy of claims, and feminists and women, other women who maybe not be feminists will be participating in that and making alternative interventions. Absolutely, we face it in the UK. Our current leader of the Labour Party was not someone most people expected to win. He is of an old left. The term that's being used, and I apologise again to the translator, is called brocialism, so bro and socialism. So there's a sense in which there is
within an old tradition of labour, a very romantic vision of working men going down mines, and that the problem that we face with this category called the left behind man is that we need to, you know, reopen those kind of old manufacturing industries. So I think there is absolutely a contest between a feminist position in the Labour Party that had been present since, you know, when they were in government in 97 to 2010, that is being challenged by a rhetoric that says you resist as a left-wing party the populism of the right by reimagining what we would call in the UK a 1950s male socialist ideology. And I think there are women in the party who are trying to contest that, but they are absolutely under threat in terms of social media violence. We have a big problem. I'm sure many of you will be aware of one of our women MPs being murdered this year for political reasons, and that was around immigration. But also women in the Labour Party every day are in receipt of social media commentary against them being feminists. And I think it's a huge problem. And I think the Labour Party thought that it had managed to reconcile that. And I am really concerned in an era of Brexit and this kind of left behind, white British male rhetoric that's got huge prominence at the moment, that feminism is yet again being presented as something that has been part of the cause of that outcome and therefore cannot in any way be a solution. And I think that's hugely problematic. So that certainty again around an adoption of a liberal, I mean, I know it's only a liberal feminism, but I think, you know, I wrote something with a colleague, Rosie Campbell, a few years ago, where we really were pretty confident that there had been the triumph of liberal feminism in British politics. And in fact, that's also something I stated in a book that I wrote about the Conservative Party, whereas they had accepted in lots of ways that there was a role for the state in intervening in terms of equal opportunities, in terms of childcare, so actually even going beyond some liberal feminist interventions in terms of making audits of companies. I worry that this new populist right rhetoric may well undermine that, and I think that will be a hugely difficult terrain to resist. And I worry that the current leadership of the Labour Party is not sufficiently of a feminist tradition. Whoops.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much, Professor Sarah Charles, for being here with us and sharing and giving us such a wonderful lecture. I think we are ready for our coffee break now, and thank you all very much. Thank you. Yes.
Vamos dar início ao primeiro painel, que se intitula Logos, Etos, Patos na representação da liderança e da participação feminina em política. Temos quatro conferencistas, uma vez que por motivos de saúde, infelizmente a Carla Batista não pode estar aqui hoje connosco. Vamos começar com uma comunicação da Carla Martins. Carla Martins é licenciada e mestre em Filosofia e doutora em Ciências da Comunicação, especialização em mídia e jornalismo, é professora da Universidade Lusófona de Humanidades e Tecnologias e assessora do Conselho Regulador da Entidade Reguladora para a Comunicação Social. É ainda investigadora do Centro Interdisciplinar de Estudos de Género, autora, entre outros, do livro Mulheres, Liderança Política e Mídia, de 2015, O Espaço Público em Hannah Arendt, o Político como Relação e Ação Comunicativa, 2005, e Política no Feminino, este último em coautoria com os restantes colegas de painel e que será apresentada amanhã no encerramento do nosso congresso. O título da comunicação, Participação Política Feminina, a Lei da Paridade numa Perspectiva Longitudinal. São 15 minutos, Carla.
Muito bom dia a todos e a todas. É um enorme prazer.
Good morning. I'm very happy for being able to participate in this international conference to this caste parity and the representation and leadership of female participation. This is what my presentation is part of our research in our center, supported by ISFT, and this will be soon published and presented during this conference. The law 2013 has been on parity has been approved, and this with the Parliament, the European Parliament, and local authorities signing. There is a sort of zip system showing that people will be, women will be included in the list. Since 2009, that we had two legislative elections, two European and two for local authority. Parity law is an important progress. And in its genesis, there is a political consent. This is a result of the socialist government led by Socrates. I'm sorry, the speaker is reading a paper which has not been given to the interpreters, and she is talking too fast. Considering this reivindication, there's a key moment to the framework of this problematic since the revolution of 1974. The structuring principle acknowledges equality of rights for, and this for a new society. The right to vote is recognized since 1974, and the number of women voting, and also women voting for, was the first time after and the revolution with a participation of 92%. With since 1975, this was considered by the United Nations the Women's International Year. The female participation, not just for voting, and also for a candidate lists, and this was the first step for the women's representation, and also considering the lack of equal rights, which were until then. The Prime Minister, Lourdes Pinto Silva, a woman, found a very good support against discrimination in Portugal and introducing the equal right for women and men. The results of these meetings that held at the time show how the preferential right and compensation mechanism for women so that equality was achieved. The representatives of the women's conditions show that this was not just the result of the revolution. The objective was parity during the summer 1975 in this very room where we are and at the National Assembly. There was a debate among the male members of parliament and the women members of parliament. And after 1976, this was not, did not have the equal support. And as in theory, these would introduce mechanisms against discrimination. according to the measures which were implemented in the democracies around Europe. An example was that a member of the parliament, a woman, said that the equal right for the women could only be achieved only when the law would acknowledge. This is clear that this meant all citizens, women and men, because the male, the plural is used. We cannot forget that these Michael Dowell and Espírito Santo say that although this progressive state, the fundamental law of 1976 showed that this was the result of a parliament where men were predominant. Virginia Ferreira noted that between 74 and 79, the social conditions for women changed in several fields. All this happened as, and this was the updating and of the society and democracy in Portugal. The country accepted it. All these were changes which happened suddenly and downstream. This is to describe the women's participation along the decades of the democracy in Portugal. If we consider the governments and distribution of the members of the parliament, in the lists for the different parties, we can find the difference. As after Portugal became a member of the European Union, the equal rights and was considered much more important. Gender streaming was created. Because of European politics in Portugal, the first public actions that took place in Portugal at the summit, the European summit, Women and Power was agreed. After, at the end of Cavaco Silva government cycle, the parity in the parliament was an initiative taken by three members of the European Parliament, women, which took place in January, February 1994. This was an important step in terms of this issue. A new a key moment took place end of the 90s when this became the, part of the political agenda. In 1975, in Beijing, the women's a conference sponsored by the United Nations took place, urging the equal participation and representation of the women. The direct participation and active participation of men and women in the political life was considered as the basis of democracy. But for the leaks, for the elections, this was rather controversial. As we know, the different legislative propositions to the quotas in the political system did not meet the approval. Ferreira Leite, president, leader of the PSD, she announced that the participation of new women in the political arena should be the natural consequence of cultural and social conditions, and not boosted by a political decision. However, because this subject was an issue for debate in the political arena, was important for the political parties. Antonio Costa, prepared a law on this, and in order to compose the list by the different parties. There's the image of secret gardens preparing candidates, following the legislative quotas, although women were not specifically mentioned. However, Socialist Party proposal did not meet the approval from the European Parliament. There are hidden barriers, although the general neutral discourse, women are always considered late and before being considered policy makers. We observed the number of women in the political parties has increased, namely at the parliament, during the second half of the 90s, and we could underline the more rightist parties. This is a national tendency. The number of women in the parliaments all around the world has increased. And we have here the evolution as a consequence of legislative elections. And we see after 75 the gap between women and men decreased. We understand throughout the 2009 and during the last elections in 2015 the difference, considering the political parties, there are some differences in the parties, but however there is here a platform. Since 2009, the right-wing party, which were at the beginning against the parity law, afterwards changed, and especially CDS and PP during the last elections elected nearly 40% women. We see here how the women have increased in the government, in the and we see during the last government, the 21st government, there is a percentage of 32.8%, which is something new in Portugal. If we consider the results of the European elections for the European Parliament, we see the number of women as members of the European Parliament has also increased, especially since the parity law has been in force in Portugal. As for the local authorities, elections, this is not so clear. Therefore, we may add that the West Indies in the executive and at the hierarchy top. If we consider the legislative elections in 2011-2015, we see that the percentage of women in 2011 was 21%, and the 2015 elections, 25%. Because I have to finish, I would summarize about this parity law, since especially from the 90s, the deficit of participation of the women became a debate, and a social debate, and therefore the political parties included more women in their internal organs and in the list for the elections. Therefore, the parity law has supported the participation of women in order to achieve the objectives. Catarina Campos from Catalonia said that this is not a danger for parity reivindications. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Carla. We're going to... Antonia Cabrera, she's a master in science of communication. She has a degree in history. She's a researcher in contemporary history of Universidade Nova de Lisboa. She's concluded projects of research, political communication and gender studies, media stories of media and journalism, freedom of expression. She's author of several books, Marcelo Caetano, Imprensa e Poder, Pesquisa em Média e Jornalismo, in 2012, Jornais, Jornalismos e Jornalistas, in 2012, and Censura Nunca Mais. The representation has suffered is parliamentary European equality between men and women. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to speak about the European Parliament and the equality between men and women. In my intervention, I'll run through the Union treaties and analyze what were the big achievements of women along this time. So, between 1957, which is the time of the Treaty of Rome, and 2007, which is the Treaty of Lisbon, which makes the big changes in the role of women in politics and other situations. So, I'll try to find reasons for the moment where we are now and in which way the political and world conjuncture can question some achievements that were made about equality issues. The European problem, the European Parliament has this composition and has achieved these improvements in the representation of women. In 1979, 84% of the members were men, against the 16% which were women. But in 1999, 70% are men, 30% are women. There was not a very substantial change, but in 1999 we can understand that there is also some integration of the principles that were approved in the platform of Peking, the Beijing platform, that were introduced and recovered by the laws of the several countries, European countries, and also by indication of the European community. In 2014, which is the last election of the European Parliament, the representation was 63% and 37% for women. It's not a very significant, still not a very significant change, but we are before a situation of a certain stagnation. We are around 30% with different representations that changes from country to country. The Treaty of Rome in 1957 was not a treaty that was very concerned about the women issues. On the contrary, the idea in that was not to mention these issues, but France required that some situations should be mentioned, which were in the Article 119, which is inscribed the equality of salaries between men and women. In some countries, Western Germany in that time, opposed this measure because they thought this did not meet their objectives at the time. This situation changes in the 70s with the feminist movements. In 75, the scope of this Article 119 will be widened and will comprehend more situations. After this, we have another period which is not contemplated by other. Between 1975 and 1997, it's a time when there are no changes regarding the treaties, but there are many directives, important directives regarding the equality in the representation of women and men and in other areas of life. So we see that, for instance, in 1975, the principle of equality in the treatment between men and women to access professions. In 1976, it's the first directive of the frame agreement about parental leave, which is made mandatory at that time. This is going to be extended to other countries. This is very interesting. Also in 1997, there is a directive, European directive, to revert the burden of proof, to prove the discrimination in the employment, this burden of proof had to be shown, made, not for who felt discriminated, but by who had the competence to deliver. In the Treaty of Amsterdam, contributes with substantial changes in the field of the legislative frameworks, namely the commitment, the European commitment is in the principles of this Amsterdam Treaty, the commitment, European commitment in the equality of genders, between genders. It's very important regarding the questions between the equality men and women in the labor field. There are several measures of directives or even of agreements that provide for ways of making these equalities a reality. The equality between men and women is inscribed in the Amsterdam Treaty, as well as the integration of the perspective of gender in all community policies. This is another idea which is also included in the Amsterdam Treaty, and which will be further developed in the Treaty of Lisbon. There are recommendations that the member states to promote the equality between men and women, regarding also the opportunity to the labor market. It is interesting to see that in around this time, and this is a decision that is a consequence of this Amsterdam Treaty, which is that in 2004 there's a decision to prevent and to fight against the violence against women, youngsters and women, and the protection of victims and the risk groups. In the Lisbon Treaty, this is a treaty that will go deeper in these issues, and that will demand that these issues are transposed to national laws. I underline this aspect because there is a difference, important difference, in the interpretation of this situation, which is the European Union, in Article 2, says the European Union is a society characterized by pluralism, non-discrimination, tolerance, justice, solidarity, equality between men and women. And another aspect, which has been underlined lately regarding the election of Trump, that underlines in the Article 10 that the European Union has the purpose to fight against discrimination in terms of sex, race, religion, ethnic, or beliefs. So in what way did these treaties add impacts in the changes of the representations? We have a graph here that shows us how in 2014 the date of the last elections for the European Parliament was what was the percentages between men and women in the several European countries. And here we can see a very interesting situation. Malta leads with 77% of women representation against 33%. Iceland, after Sweden, that we know, Finland, etc. And then in the level, we have lower level, we have Cyprus with 17%, Latvia and Hungary with 19%. This situation is a situation that we had and we have since the last election in 2014. Now the issue is to understand what is going to go to what happened from now on. The different routes, and in other achievements that have been made in the meantime, how can this evolve? There is a situation which goes beyond all of this, but is part of the national and international context. From the creation of monetary union, the European Union leaves a period of stagnation. This is recognized by several authors. The purposes, the core purposes, is the safety of the property rights, the liberties of investors, and the discipline of the labor market. And we have also to guarantee the issues regarding the balance between currencies and global capitals. This issue, we see that the big purpose, what are the big purposes in the neoliberal policies, and they focus mainly on the discipline for the governments, mainly making them to respect certain situations that are associated to the globalization, the privatization, the deregulation, the flexibility, the monetary policies, risk provision. Another characteristic is that members of the several states of the European Union are ignored in the regulation of this competition. So we go now to, from a concept, an interesting concept of a state, to a concept of work for state, according to some authors. The issue, the effects of this policy, the Pact of Stability also contributes exactly for to enable that this situation of austerity is inscribed from the beginning for the monetary union, the European Monetary Union, and this underlines the or contributes to underline the inequality of opportunities between men and women. Looking at the European political guidelines, we understand that the equalities of between men and women have accelerated in the decade of 90, in the 90s. There is a drop from 2008, and this has to do with the financial crisis. And this trend is a trend for a stagnation and also for a return in some activity sectors. And this has consequences in the position and the questions of equality of men and women. This is not a core situation anymore, although the European Parliament will never go oppose the decisions that they have made before. As concluding, I consider that the neoliberalism combines with globalization, a process that is ongoing and which transformations in all sectors are not defined yet. But this is a big problem because we see that this is a primacy of finance over politics. There are indications to have a profound social transformation and also and especially the precarity of citizenship. This is a reality in the labor market, for instance. And I would like to quote this sentence from Nancy Fraser in from 1989, where she reveals interestingly how the neoliberal politics can constitute a factor of going back in the achievements about equality, regarding equality. And I would like to say also, in when we speak about these achievements, we see that they are very recent. They get speed up in 1985 with the decisions of the Beijing platform. This, all of this is very recent, and all of this can be changed as fast as it has been introduced. If the situations change, it can be changed. Many things can be changed that we can we must think that no achievement is irreversible and history is not a linear evolution. Thank you very much for your attention.
Muito obrigada, Ana. Vou então...
Vou apresentar as duas.
I shall introduce the two last speakers. We are going to combine their presentation. Teresa Mendes Flores, a PhD on a communication by the Universidade de Nova, and a researcher at Universidade Lusófona in Lisbon, research on journalism, cinema, and published photographer and cinema. Beyond several other papers published. Her presentation is journalistic presentations on and feminine analysis of debates and approval of a parity law. Maria José Mata, a PhD on communication at the Instituto Politécnico de Lisboa. She coordinated the master degree at this university, and she studies the practice on of journalism, self-criticism on journalism. Her presentation is on journalistic constructions and a leader personality. Good morning. I would like to make an introduction of our presentation. And considering that the other presentations dealt with the evolution of representativity and parity policies, we are going to talk about media representations of this evolution. Therefore, we would like to discuss here how, in terms of the media, through journalism, the women's representation and gender has been in very specific moment been done. As for the politics, not just men and women have a different access to power, but also how they are represented by the media. The data of this project of 2015 are clear. This shows that women are only present in 24% of the news, and only when these news are about politics and the government. Therefore, data of 2015 show less 3% compared to 2010. They are also less visible in the media when they are interviewed according to their personal experience. But as experts, they are called 19% only, and only 22% as speakers. As for the majority of the men do it as politicians, they perform it as housewives or mothers. As for the news on economy, only 5% policies or 7% are those who are women are less visible. This report also shows that the weak visibility of women in the media also has been transferred to digital platforms, where they are only 26% present, the women. this research also confirms the stereotypes in the media. Only 4% of the news show these stereotypes, which show an evolution 1% and during the last years, or recent years, and on news connected with the politics, there's no evolution. Therefore, stereotypes are really rooted in the news. Stereotypes are mental ideas, systems which underline socially
as representações de género,
gender. The stereotypes are usually showing the roles performed by women or men. Like authors like England refers. This is also shown in the media. Usually stereotypes are shown in a negative form, but authors like those I've the speaker said show that the stereotypes may be have positive aspects, especially when politicians become candidates. Some authors also show different issues on this unbalance. I would like to show, for example, Sharon Kahn says that the media take a less time describing women compared to men. Karen Ross, she also refers in 2009 that woman is also described as a woman, as a politician, emphasis therefore on her as a woman. The characteristic or typical politician has not specific gender. In this study or this research, which has been mentioned here before, we noticed that in some situations, so specific situations, that the members, the Portuguese members of the parliament, are less mentioned on themes like the abortion or others on discussions around the political parity between 1994 and 2006. During this period, this is connected to leadership values which are associated to men traditionally. Now, I would like to pass the floor to Teresa Mendes Flores, who is going to discuss the journalistic representations of women, specifically considering the approval of a parity law.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation and your presence in this session. I would like to start to speak about the importance of the representations in the sense of the stories that are told about where there is a narrative, non-explicit narrative, on the construction and the diversity between genders. I would like to warn you for the dangers of the single history that we have one version only of these social roles, of these identities, that happens many often. And this indication explains a little why in our work we had several components that are patent in what we are showing. We started to identify all the evolution of the political participation of women in the parliament in Portugal. And to put it into context, and in an international way, and we wanted to highlight the importance of the media, the effect of media in this conjugation between the political representation of member of parliament and political lists, but also the role that the media have in the construction of this visibility of the policies of the members parliament, male and female. So we talked about the stories and the importance they have in the construction of these identities. Our big question was not only to understand those figures, the counting of the bodies, as Charles was saying, but how they are constructed, how they are represented. And the photography, the issue of the photography, we worked only the breasts. When we worked television from the 90s with the private TVs, there was a big spectrum, and the role of TV increased. Maria José will make a short approach. We have, but as I said, we focused on the written press, and we wanted to bring you some very naturalized, which is the photographic representation of the parliament, of the member of the parliament, male and male. I was talking about the importance of stories. There are many works, happily, fortunately, on this area, about the construction of gender, and now this starts from that question, is it a boy or a girl, regarding the expectation of having a boy or a girl. And I wanted to share a story. I read stories with my boy, and we are reading story by Roald Dahl called The Fantastic Mr. Raposo. The story is about a fox that tries to escape the farmers, but only the the only hero, the female fox receives the chicken and cooks them. I'm always saying for my child, but the female foxes also do something. So these stories of expectations, this construct builds the identity of genders. We all know about this. When we speak about characters in their journalistic construction, we are talking about the idea of the stories that the journalism tells, and the stories that the journalism tells through photographies. And the photography medium is maybe a big naturalization instance, because it's obvious that the photographers say, if the women are not there, how can I take a picture of them? They have to be there. This is the first item. In our work, we have counted the number of photographies with men and women, and then with the members of the parliament, male and female. They have to be there, of course, but the concern, and you will see that we have understood that in most... We studied the debates of the interruption of pregnancy and the parity debates. And in the debates of the interruption of gravity, there is many male images. This doesn't happen in the mediatage of the parity, when there are more pictures of female members of parliament than male members of parliament. We tried to understand if there was a difference in the way of representing in photograph the male and female members of parliament. We tried to articulate qualitative and quantitative methodologies. The quantitative methodologies served us to try to find patterns and things that in isolated cases we discover, but we and ask ourselves if this is a trend or not. It's obvious that the generalization of the results is also always an interrogation question. Well, regarding the characters, we find the characters that are not fictional. It's not the E-Fox or She-Fox. They are members of the parliament that exist in this house, that are sources of the journalists, who are not passive, because they are not fictional characters. They have intervention, they have opinions, they have interventions. There is an ethics, and I would like to call your attention to the ethos and pathos of the communication, logos, ethos and pathos, because we are trying to see how the characters build the ethos. Logos, ethos and pathos are the aristotelic discussion associated with the rational logic of the speeches. Pathos is more associated to the manner how this speech is built, wrapped to reach its auditorium, to produce an emotion, to produce to touch the audiences, and how the photography has a very important role, because being an image, see, it's an element that has a very strong emotional impact. So the ethos is constructed in the speech, both in images as in and in texts. As I was saying, ethos in journalism is the institution, the journalistic institution. It's all the question of the truth and the trust that the journalist's speech brings to us. The photography brings also the testimony, the witness, something that happened. And ethos of the characters is a construction together between the manner, the way how the journalist sources react and represent their agenda, and the speech, journalist speech. And we speak about the ethos of the characters. We see which resources, how the journalism represents them. And this has to do with ethics as well, because obviously you are talking about characters which are not fictitious, but there is a construction, how this is constructed, that does which depends of all these combination of forces. And as I said, the photography naturalizes, because we believe that thing happened, but how this is done, and some of those are the angles, the framing, the composition, the focus, the lighting, the gestures. And for the efficiency of the communication, this is the resource to many visual conventions that come from tradition. And we remember on ancient stories that come from the Christian iconography in our past, and the stereotypes of gender, the gender stereotypes, which are also present. And we'll try to see some examples. I choose to illustrate this slide. One of the first events that put in the pot to the public, the quotas, the parity issues. and I used the opportunity to show this photography that made the big headlight. We have Il Deputado Maria Bello coming in this room, more or less where I am, and she was photographed, as you see, and where this idea of a transparency, of a ghostly aspect of her volatility results in a visual connotation about what will be the sense of this parity parliament that generates many controversy, that was a mediatic success, where female members of parliament. This is only an example to how there is a construction of connotations. There is this idea of an opening, a sleeping opening with a sleeping beauty, but where the invisibility of the woman appears in this photography in this sort of transparency, but also as a lost soul. One of the characters I'm going to speak about is the parliament itself. And we can see that there was, in the use of photography, we are in the 80s, where we have several plans of the parliament, where we have generate plans. And what is important is the collective. There is the presence of the parliament as a character. The example of the depenalization of abortion, where we see this presence of the members of parliament that rise. It's the parliament in its dynamic that is here. In the 90s, we'll have a different look. The main actor, parliament, male parliament member, and government as well, politician as well. We have some non-faces. This is not the institution far from the parliament, but the daily life, the negotiations, and it's the parliament is looked as a theater, and this change is significant because we understand that it's around the members of parliament that all these stories, they will be the characters of their journalist stories. We'll still have ways of looking at the parliament, and the parliament will be present, but dramaturgy regarding the members of parliament, male and male, male and female, it's a very important means of construction of the persona. The characteristics, the attributions, the actions of the members of the parliament, male and female. On the debates, now going to the parity issue and putting it into our work, we studied in the case in 2006, but there is an enormous disproportion between what was the impact of the three debates that we've studied about abortion depenalization and the 300 photographies in one case, 42 on the other. So this event keeps the same profile. In 2006, we find only 10 piece news, 14 photography pictures. There is not a highlight of first page. It's a routine matter. They are always relegated to the inside of the journal. There are opinion articles of opinion that are against the legal the parity law, although we have two journalists that follow the case, Sanjelapa, but most of the voices of the opinion articles of opinion are male, but there are also women which are against the quotas. This is a question of ideological position. This was a subject that was not very highlighted, very stressed. When it was approved in 2006, it didn't get too much visibility, but the female member for the parliament are in these 14 pictures that we have found. In 2006 and in other conclusions, we knew that the criteria will look at who proposes the laws and usually who comes to the floor to present, to submit the law, and also the representatives of the parties in those debates. The leaders of the parties are more photographed also because they are related to controversy. There is another aspect that we have concluded, which is not very difficult to understand. The journalism is a very pays a lot of attention to the leadership position. So if women are not in the leadership positions, they won't be the peak persons of these parties. But even if, when they have these positions, they still appear less. So the members of parliament with officers appear more, the male parliament members appear in 26%, the female 20%, more protagonism, male protagonism 56%, 27% of female. It has to do with this idea that in fact the leadership is associated . We didn't use these concepts in a book called Leading Image, Conceptual Image and Narrative Image, in the quantitative analysis. We used only in the qualitative analysis. But I'm going to use a little bit with you in an exercise that I proposed to you. A conceptual image is an image that aims to describe attributes, its essences. The portraits, for instance, where we try to describe characteristics. Sometimes it is difficult because we have portraits of people acting, but typically the portrait, the person is in posing. Another narrative image tells a story with the authors call vectors, dynamic relations corresponding to the verbs. There is an action which is described in the image. We have an admirable picture of Adriana Miranda regarding the discussion of the interruption of pregnancy, where we have Mari Soares scolding Guterres because he was against the interruption of abortion for religious reasons. And in these narrative images, who is the subject of the action, who is the main person that acts, and the reactors, who reacts to these actions, and the representative of leadership is associated to being the main actor, to act, and to be surrounded by his peers or the people that follow them. In this case, clearly, Suarez is the subject of the action. In the caption and the title, although there is a balance of they are both in a rivalry with the same dimension, the same scale, more or less the same framing, although the gesture of Maestro makes him the agent, although Guterres is not quiet, is not represented as in a passive way. In the reactors, we have the mediatic apparatus, as we have the member of the parliament, Manuel Alegre, who was in favor of the law to interrupt pregnancy. And he is laughing. He is happy with the situation. So there is, this was a gesture. He was probably doing, but the strength of the gesture makes that many times the connotations emerge from those gestures that in its original context didn't mean that. The interpretation, photography interpretation is that. The conceptual images and narrative images is an issue. If it is true, if we have many images that are only the faces of people, and here male are predominant. Here there are two examples of the mediatization in 1999 of the parity law, here with a portrait of the Belgian minister with the subject of the action, and she's mentioned, quoted in the title, but who appears looking in an introspective way. It's a conceptual image. Antonio Costa, who was the proposal, who proposed this law in 1999, is in a typical photography for the representation of the member of parliament. And we didn't find many with these characteristics, but we found several female member of states. We have a person that is standing, that is intervening, and we have the reactors behind that are paying attention to him. And we also have the title and the caption. He is the subject. One of the characters that appears constantly as an active one person was Odette Santos, a communist member of the parliament. The trend is she is permitted, represented in action, but for reasons that have to do with the individual characteristics and the way she is photographed, tells many stories of mistrust in this action. We have a group of members of parliament that are not paying attention to Odette Santos. She's also the subject of the caption. I don't see. Can you see a member of parliament that is peeping? We don't know if he is a follower or not. And there is as if the intervention was a bit confused. This capacity of intervening of women is more criticized or criticizable.
Another example. And in March 1999, she's looking not in front. She's not looking down, but in front and pointing out. In this case, this is nowhere else. Women also negotiate. We can see here an example, and 2006. Among these 14 photos, what do we have? We have the to anticipate the debate with the Member of Parliament, Matilde Sousa Franco. She's in the center. She's represented in more a quiet way. And now also on the symbolism, there is no gender distinction, but this is the experience I've mentioned before of the six MPs, and also anticipating the debate on the 30th March. Only the following day, the news on the debate came out in the press. And although we had there an active MP on the phone. And here the only voice stated is Alberto Martins, a man. Maria de Belém, who is a woman, she was also mentioned in other news, but not in this one. She is here in this image beside Alberto Martins. But she is represented as in a quiet way and not on intervention. Looking at papers, and the only one intervening, it's this MP, Anna Manso, but not too clear. Here some suggestions on affirmative as a man and as a woman. Sometimes now very quickly, just to show you the women who work too much, who are overloaded. This is a photo showing a woman looking at the papers. Always looking at papers, reading papers. And this is a paper. So 5 minutes beyond the time schedule. So I would like you to ask you to summarize as much as possible, to be brief.
Já é uma, não é?
Bem, boa tarde de novo, uma vez que tenho pouco tempo.
Well, I would like to be short to, because we are beyond schedule. This is a project on course, still on course, to access how women's representation and leadership nowadays is different compared to the research performed before, which was here shown. This is a political transition from CDS-PP party and Assunção Cristas for the first time. She was replacing Paulo Portas, who had been a leader of the party for decades. He decided not to continue and ran over to Assunção Cristas. This is news that I found out because this is one of the first news on the press showing a possibility for the candidates who could replace Paulo Portas as a party leader. Three names for men, but they forget Assunção Cristas, who is a woman. This could be a mistake, but in the text, then afterwards in the text underneath the photo, her name is mentioned. This research is the following. We observed the media documents and then different three broadcast channels during the Congress. We decided this political transition moment in order to see how the same event had been shown or shall be presented. This is a notion. This is a framing concept, is quite ideologic, and so, from this framing issue, we defined several levels. The first level, how the event is shown, and secondly, about the person. This was an event which had been programmed before. The media were attentive and very much interested in this event. Therefore, even before the Congress, this had been prepared by the media. As for the analysis, we studied how the person itself, himself or herself, is built. The character in terms of journalism is different from the real one. As journalism has a contract established with the reality. As for the event itself, we noticed that the important event was the succession, because all the news even broadcasted during the first day of the Congress of this party, there was only one candidate, Assunção Cristas. This was not controversial. There was no conflict because she was the only candidate. Therefore, this was the framing which was the important one, the framing of the succession. This shows how between Paulo Portas and Assunção Cristo was given. The first day of the Congress was dedicated to Paulo Portas leaving the party leadership. His own tears are shown, and incidences on Paulo Portas was troubled and very I was very touched by his own leaving the party. And also the news gave the opinion of the different members of the party. Assunção Cristas is shown as the successor to Paulo Portas, a succession which is a natural one, but also as a rupture most of the impressions then for the people, different people, and also her own speech show a difference. Assunção Cristas has a leadership style which is different from the previous leader, Paulo Portas. This interview was very interesting. This was at the television channel RTP1. Assunção Cristas is answering questions on leadership, which leadership she wishes to lead. Compared to the other leadership, she says at a certain stage, answering a question which was, were their charismatic leaders beforehand, and she says women are not much aggressive. Somebody gives the example of Margaret Thatcher, and she says she is not identified with Margaret Thatcher, but she is much more flexible. And this shows how the transition will be performed by her. There would be other interesting aspects which we have no time here to present. On terms of succession, and now the framing on terms of the personality, the character. She is shown as woman, and a woman and also a mother. And she shows on the terms of journalism and personal one. She brings her own family to the Congress. Her family is photographed, also interviewed during the Congress. The family is very important during the Congress and for the media. This framing was not a framing chosen by the media, but prepared by herself, as framings are easy ways of telling a story. She is qualified as a modern, updated mother, as a woman, not so sexual, but for example, we see her the feet, but allusions to power. Power will be on high heels now. And there was news with the title "CDS now is wearing high heel shoes," and they focus on the high heel shoes longer than on her own face. We could discuss later other details if you wish. Thank you. Now we have some minutes more for debate. I would like to remind the colleagues, our peers who cannot speak in Portuguese, you may speak in English because there's a simultaneous translation.
Good morning again. I would like to ask you three. Ana Cabrera, she showed the data for the European Parliament and said that Malta and Ireland have high rates. Do you have a justification for the difference that we find among the countries? Then for Maria José Mata, regarding your first intervention, you said that women appear less in media. when you spoke about the database that was analyzed. And my question is in the database, there were elements or details about if women refuse invitations more. From my experience, I see that my male colleagues accept when to speak to the media. And my sensation or my feeling is that women only respond when they feel they are experts on the field. The number of invitations and the refusals. And regarding the study that Teresa Mendes submitted, and I thought it was very interesting, my question is, regarding the abortion, there were more male voices, parity, more women, in pictures, more men as well. It would be interesting to make a relation with the reality. There were more men when the topic was abortion. But if we analyzed from the base, men spoke more. Are the media that biased, or is the debate that is biased? And the last question for everyone, probably, it's more a curiosity, my curiosity. When I submit similar topics out abroad, many times I speak, I hear about parity parliament, and my sensation that in Portugal the parity parliament had less visibility and less consequence than when this issue is analyzed abroad, because I think that it had more repercussion in other countries than in ours. More questions? Bom dia. Good morning. I'm from Torres Novas. My question is, Premier José Mata, when you chose this leader, you didn't explain why you had... why did you choose this leader, Assunção Cristas?
Not
Catarina Martins. I think that you didn't have time. She doesn't use any high heels, but she's still a woman. Thank you. More questions? I would like to make a question that is more like to provoke you. I, as a journalist, we interview more men, more expert male than men, women. Taking into account that we have more and more journalists, female journalists, shouldn't these female journalists try to interview female experts? But you also said that women are not so much available and they are a bit afraid when they are not they don't feel themselves as expert in the matter.
Thank you. As for the mini monitor data, I didn't record that information. I wonder whether it's variable, but it's not a variable to be accountable. It's a variable which would could confirm at least one valid reason for that representation in specific roles. I have that information. As for the questions, your question, this is because of routines. As for the sources, institutional sources, there are routines which entitle access ways, which is much more among the male institutions. At least this is part of the explanation. As the question, which I find it very interesting, my idea, considering the situation. I picked up Assunção Quiristas because I found it as a paradigmatic and recent example when she became, for the first time, a leader, a party leader, and with that characteristic, which is interesting. My idea, which is going to be developed, is to study leadership. For example, comparing Assunção Quiristas and Catarina Martins it may be very interesting on terms of leadership as for gender, because styles are different. One is leader, although she has no family, she's not wearing high-heeled shoes. She knows and uses the media in a way which is much more effective, as the media, updated media logics. I couldn't proceed yet, but I'm going to continue on that, because this case is just shown as an example, an exercise, not a paradigmatic case. As for Iceland and Malta, these data are data which are amazing. I'm doing some research on the European Parliament, and I'm curious to know, because we expect Sweden or Finland to have a stronger female participation, but why Iceland, why Malta? It's quite amazing, but we didn't find out the reason yet. As for your question, as on the paritarian parliament at the when it was created, was on all news and newspapers and televisions. Several newspapers had the news on their front page. But how the presentation was done, how was it performed, what the framing was, this is very interesting to access. As for the issue, either the media who proceed the debate, if women cannot be photographed, for example, we found out and we are amazed at that, especially on the debates the voluntary interruption. We found it quite curious. Because we recorded the debates, or we studied the debates recorded. There's a strong discrepancy during the debates on the voluntary interruption, but this, the ratio is 80 compared to 4 or 5. But the women who interviewed were Rita Seabra from the Communist Party and Seabra Mora and from MDP, CDE party. they have participated with long interventions, but men also took the floor. But if we had to find out percentage, they wouldn't take any photos of women. Rita Seabra was shown at several stages during the debate which took place in 1982. Natalia Correia, who was a writer, a poet, also was photographed. We found more parity as for the number of photos taken to the MPs, men and women, in 84, more than photos during debates in 97-98, although there were more women in parliament. There were questions on the conflict. During the debates of 97-98, there was a referendum, and the leaders of different parties, Angela Cão and Francisco Assis, were the ones who intervened more often. Therefore, there wasn't an increase on term of parity. Just after the revolution of the 25th April, this humor occurred connected to the journalist choice. They must speak the women in order to be represented. And the news of 2006 on love of parity, it's Maria Belém, who is a woman, who introduces this. But there is no photo of Maria Belém speaking, standing up, but we have a photo of Antonio Costa with men standing up. Anna has already mentioned the parity law. We didn't study the impact abroad, but the paradigm used was the one of soft news. The MPs, women arriving, worried about how they look, then their hairstyle. They invited one MP, and therefore this fait divers was considered rather than other issues. There's just a photo of Maria Santos, standing up among her papers in this same room. But as for the other women, who came, the invitation, so the people invited, this was a sort of the narrative given by the media, a sort of a Mickey Mouse story. And as Teresa has said, this was an event which we do not recall as much because maybe there was this light journalism of the event. Nearly as if it was a ball or a social event. So the European Commission, when it supports this initiative in Portugal, this agenda, it's much more serious. Therefore, more attention given to, in different countries, to this law on parity in politics. This was also the year of Athens conference, Women in Power, to Power. Therefore, the ludic characteristic of the event didn't allow it to take it more seriously. But this agenda is important. This is the very end of Cavaco Silva's government, the previous government. Just afterwards, there is political view from Antonio Guterres, a socialist party leader, which became the next government. This event was used in terms of political purposes. This is interesting to think about. Thank you. Now we shall have a pause for lunch and resume at 2:30.
Okay. Quatro. Okay. Três.
Um, dois, três.
Thank you.